Lake Effect brings you conversations about what's happening in Milwaukee and the people, places, and organizations that shape the community. This is Lake Effect Spotlight from WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Milwaukee native Ira Madison III is a cultural critic, TV writer, and host of the Crooked Media podcast, Keep It. Coming up next week, he's adding author to his many titles with the release of his debut essay collection, Pure Innocent Fun. The book explores key cultural moments that inspired his career as a critic and impacted his life growing up as a Black gay man in Milwaukee. For Madison, TV shows, movies, and books were not just an escape, but turned out to be a tool for connection. He takes readers on a trip through the 90s and 2000s, diving into everything from Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Oprah's talk show, and weekly trips to Mayfair Mall to see as many films as he could. Ira Madison III joins me to share more, and to start, here's an excerpt from Pure Innocent Fun.
February 2nd, 1999 marked the release of the most important historical text since the Bible. The Bible, of course, being the print edition of Entertainment Weekly, February 1990 to April 2022. A scrub is a guy that can't get no love from me, hanging out the passenger side of his best friend's ride, trying to holla at me. TLC's No Scrubs was a seminal text for me, the version with Left Eye's rap only. Not only because it was a massive hit, but because my mom and sister routinely lobbed the lyrics at me over the fact that I never got my driver's license in high school. For most teenagers in Milwaukee, a car represents freedom. For instance, my younger sister got her driver's permit as soon as she could. But for me, who had a life that revolved around watching TV and walking to the comic book store and going to the movies at the mall, Mayfair Mall, there didn't seem to be much of a need to get my license. Besides, driver's ed seemed to happen immediately after school, and that coincided with rehearsals for the school plays. I worked on the stage crew for each show at Marquette University High School because I was finding myself falling in love with theater more and more. And if I couldn't be cast in a show, then I'd at least take a job that would let me take part in all the magic that I dreamed about when I would listen to the Rent original Broadway cast recording in my bedroom and try to make my high-pitched gay voice deep enough to match Adam Pascal's raspy voice on the song Another Day.
Ira Madison III, welcome to Lake Effect. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
So first off, congratulations on your first book, Pure Innocent Fun. It's a collection of essays that shares stories and snippets of your life through the connective lens of pop culture, and specifically millennial pop culture. So first off, what was the inspiration for you to write these memories to share with us in this format?
Well, so my favorite book in high school was Chuck Klosterman's Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs. And I think that was maybe the first thing, aside from like VH1's Best Week Ever, or, you know, like the I Love the 80s franchise, that introduced me to people talking about pop culture, talking about their memories of pop culture and how they influenced their lives, how they sort of made the decade make sense in a way. And I revisited that book often. I lent it to friends and I got it back. And I think around 2020, you know, when we were all at home for a very long time, I reread it for the first time, maybe in a few years. And it sort of hit me that I wanted to make my own version of that and a version that was sort of a tribute to that.
What's most central in your book is, of course, Milwaukee, right? And your formative years here. And I have to say that reading this gave me such a nostalgia hit and comfort, not just as a millennial, but also as a Milwaukee native like yourself. So the visualizations were particularly strong, and it felt like reminiscing. Yeah, it just felt like reminiscing about the early aughts with a friend and like all the stupid things we did in high school or the things that were happening in pop culture, what we were obsessing over, you know. So can you share more about your upbringing here in Milwaukee and how it influenced not simply the essays you wrote, but of course your whole perspective?
Yeah, you know, my earliest memories that I write about are when I attended Highland Community School as a kid, and that led me to Morse Middle School. And I really enjoyed those schools a lot. Those were some of the more diverse schools in Milwaukee. And then after middle school, my culture shock was going to Marquette High School, which was an all-boys school. And at the time, you know, it was a largely all-white school too. So I think that that is something that definitely affected, you know, my upbringing and also sort of just thrust me into a world I wasn't really familiar with. And I think I retreated a lot into myself. I retreated a lot into books, into TV, into film. And the way that I was able to make friends with people was through discussing pop culture, discussing Seinfeld reruns, discussing Simpsons reruns, and spending nights watching movies with friends in their parents' basements. And that, I think, prepared me for college, where I was able to, you know, not connect with people as easily socially as other people immediately, but I could connect with people on music and pop culture. And I think that that really just sort of led me down the career path that I've had ever since.
Yeah, we grow up with these things and we latch on to like shows or movies, like maybe without knowing the significance at the time. And, you know, while I don't share the same experiences as you, such as going to Marquette High as one of a handful of Black students at a predominantly white school, I have to say I deeply empathize hard with the way you wrote about escaping into TV, movies, fanfic, you know, everything that gives you a safe space mentally. So do you think this is why pop culture and the nostalgia around it can be so powerful?
Yeah, I think that especially in a world, you know, where we have so much niche culture now, you know, there's not the monoculture of whatever was on TV last night, chances are everyone watched it, you know? And if you didn't watch it, your parents watched it or your sibling watched it, you were at least familiar with it, you know? And now I think with there being so many disparate things to watch, you know, not everyone is watching Severance, you know? Not people barely watch network TV. Maybe, you know, Real Housewives is sort of a monoculture, but you know, I have friends who don't watch that as well, you know? And I think that these memories of things that we all love, that we all remember, sort of one, remind you of a place and time when you consume them. And then they also help you connect with your peers. There's this thing that people always say, and I mentioned it in the book, where you remember experiencing something in the past. And in a way, it feels like you were the only person who experienced that, like you and your friends. How many times have you seen a viral post online where someone starts with the prompt, name a TV show that you've watched that you're pretty sure no one else has ever seen, etc. And sometimes people name shows that were pretty popular, like everyone's seen ER or Friends, yeah. And they've heard about it. But you know, sometimes people will name much smaller shows that were canceled, you know, like a Pushing Daisies, shows that were canceled very quickly. And I think that when you go back and actually look at how many people watch those shows, we lived in a culture where, sure, the biggest shows on television got maybe 30 million viewers a week. And that show got maybe 10 million a week. And that's why it was canceled. But in this day and age, 10 million viewers a week would be a huge hit, you know? I think a lot of the things that felt niche and small to us at the time, millions of people actually have that same experience, you know? I think we just did not have the internet. We didn't have social media. We didn't have a way to know that the things that you were experiencing by yourself at home were lived experiences that many people had, not just in the U.S., but across the globe.
You know, in your books and your experiences, it's not just the power of pop culture, but especially the queer perspective of pop culture. And I think that also is a big factor in how millennials today are also viewing things, not just of their past, but today. Like before, it'd be all about little hints of subtext we could get, right? But, you know, it's more than that. It's camp. It's the random things we obsess over. And you have a podcast all about that too, right? So can you explain the importance of that lens?
Yeah, so my podcast, Keep It, which I've hosted for about 7 years now with my co-host, Louis Vertel, We dive into current pop culture each week, but we also always divert into nostalgic moments that we remember, sort of our tastes that have been developed by how we view things as young queer people in the 90s and early 2000s. And I think that it gives us also a different lens into pop culture right now, films that might seem on the surface a lot more queer, you know, that there's characters who are explicitly gay, you know, they're people talk about their real queer lives, but I don't know, it feels a little bit like when you watch maybe films from the 50s or something, you know, or sort of like pre-code films where people had to talk in code and there was innuendo. And in a way, it feels like some of those pieces of culture are a lot more queer than many of the things that we experience now, just because people had to work with intent to really make those characters seem gay, really make those characters connect with an audience who would understand it. And now it just seems as if you can throw a character in something, say they're gay, and move on, you know?
I'm going to take a quick moment to reintroduce you. This is Like Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski, speaking with author and Milwaukee native Ira Madison III. So Ira, you've written for GQ, Vulture, The Cut, and MTV News, among others. But a story assignment obviously is very different to writing about your life through the lens of pop culture. So yes. Did you have any aspects of writing this book that felt strange or intimidating to you at first? Like, did it take a minute to find your voice when you're used to like, okay, this is my editorial voice on this one thing, but okay, we're getting personal now?
Yeah, you know, I have a very distinct writing style. You know, I called it ADD earlier, but I feel like comes across in my writing style too. I write the way that I speak. I write the way that I discuss topics on the podcast as well. We will, for instance, be talking about the Golden Globes and the wins, and then we will all of a sudden divert into, you know, we'll talk about a film that won and we'll talk about the actor that was in that, and that will lead us into talking about other films of theirs and someone else who was in that movie. You know, I feel like it's my book is sort of like a road trip and you're making a lot of different stops along the way, but you're eventually going to get to the destination. And when I write an assignment, which is much shorter, you know, something like 900 to 1200 words, it's edited down a lot, for one. And those diversions maybe only happen once. You know, you start with an intro topic and then you veer into the meat of your story. And then maybe you'll end with a kicker that's surprising or something, you know? And I think that I got so used to writing like that, you know, like it's you get an assignment, especially when you're writing about pop culture and it moves so fast, especially with the internet, you get an assignment in the morning and you need it done by the afternoon. This was sitting with topics that nothing was changing about them. You know, there wasn't new information. I didn't have to rush it out. And I was also reflecting more on my perspective and how much I wanted to share about my life. And, yeah, it felt like it went on forever, you know, trying to write, trying to get to that destination in each essay. And luckily, I found a healthy balance. I found a mode of doing that worked after the first couple of essays. But just starting the book was probably the hardest aspect of it for me.
Yeah. And I do like how the footnotes kind of serve as side quests, like, oh, remember, like, go look this up if you haven't seen it in a minute, or this is the cultural significance.
Love
of this
a footnote.
Moment. Yes. I like the twist on the footnote. That was fun as a reader. You mentioned pop culture can change so rapidly and, you know, there's a new news bite every day. What would you say are like the best and worst things about being a cultural critic and having to stay on the pulse of all these things?
Well, one of the worst things is also a best thing, a sort of a two-edged sword, you know, it's there is so much to consume. I am constantly feeling like I haven't listened to an album that I need to be listening to. I haven't seen a movie that I haven't seen. I haven't seen The Brutalist yet, for instance. I need to find a way to carve out 4 hours in my afternoon to go and see it. And it's certainly not going to happen now when I'm, you know, embarking on a book tour. But there's also something great about that because there is so much to consume. You know, I love one of my text threads that I have with a close friend, Ted. We just send each other new songs that we're listening to back and forth every day. We sort of start our day with a new song, and I have friends who do the same with books. So I think now I sort of rely on my sort of community of people to let me know what I should be watching or listening to. But it is hard to sort of be abreast of everything. Also, you know, you want to go to your creature comforts often. You know, you want to rewatch a movie that you love. You want to keep watching Bravo and not doing anything else. You know, it's a bit hard to do that.
Absolutely. In your book, you stated, especially in your teenage years, that you're on a diet of white pop culture media in a rejection of your mother. And, you know, I think a lot of families can identify with that. And also, if my family is good at one thing, it's not asking questions, especially Midwestern yes. families. I'm sure it goes beyond the Midwest, right? But in writing this book, how have you felt sharing it with your family and the people closest to you?
Well, they have not read it yet. So
it's to be determined.
They will get their copies of the book in person when I do my stop in yeah. Milwaukee.
I know. It must be a scary thought, though, because you were living in your own world and your brain processing, living life as best you could, while they have one perspective of it too, right?
Exactly. Yeah. But also, I would say that I'm less worried about some family members, particularly my grandmother, who I dedicate the book to. She is an avid fan of mine. She is the one who always encouraged me to write a book when I was younger. She's the one who would always take me to the bookstore after school. She was excited that I was finally writing a book after doing, you know, media and television for so long, just because she knew it was a dream I'd had when I was a kid. And she listens to the podcast sometimes too. And, you know, you sort of forget that that's happening. But sometimes she'll bring up something and I'm like, oh, you read that. And it's happened a couple other times where my mom or my sister has read something very personal and I forget that they're going to be reading it. So I'm pretty okay with my family reading those things. And, you know, I've sort of told them, if there's something here you don't like, then you'll have to keep that to yourself.
It's already printed.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, before I let you go, I have a pressing question. So we got Buffy, some other great TV representation. What's your take on Xena Warrior Princess? She wasn't included in your book.
I love Xena Warrior Princess. I thought I maybe had something in there earlier that might have gotten cut. I made a reference to Hercules, the TV series, which, and I say that, you know, Kevin Sorbo, don't love him now, but right. I did love Hercules. Xena, perfect television show. I've contemplated a rewatch many times, but before Buffy, for me, there was Xena, and I watched Xena every week. Every time she threw her weapon, every time she made her battle cry, I was all in on Xena, and the family was too. That was a show that everybody in the house loved.
Oh, I love that. Well, while you're in town, I hope you get some Cousin Subs while you're here to treat yourself.
Yes. Oh, my God. I love Cousins.
Yes.
Jimmy, we have Jimmy John's out here, and it just does not hit. Sorry.
Not the same. Yeah. Well, thank you, Ira, so much for talking with me today. I really enjoyed reading your book and kind of going down your memory lane and remembering stuff on my part as well. And so enjoy talking with you.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I really appreciate it.
Milwaukee native Ira Madison III is a cultural critic, TV writer, and host of the Crooked Media podcast Keep It. His new collection of essays is called Pure Innocent Fun, and Madison will be at the Oriental Theater on February 3rd for a book event in partnership with Boswell Book Company. You can find more information at wuwm.com.
You can find more interviews like this one by visiting wuwm.com/lakeeffect. And while you're there, subscribe to the Lake Effect Spotlight podcast.